Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We do have two main clusters of relatively lush pastures and rangelands at this point in the season.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey on where we'll find lush pasture and rangeland conditions.
We actually see 14 states east of the Mississippi River with rangeland and pastures rated anywhere from 50 to 80% good to excellent. Near the top of that list, New York State at 71%, Pennsylvania at 70%, and then leading the southeastern states, we have a tie, 65% good to excellent in Tennessee and Florida. The other cluster of pretty lush conditions, even for this time of year, we do have a five-state area of the western United States that includes Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, all ranging from 50 to 80% good to excellent.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We ended up on our proposal with seven Republicans and seven Democrats and others who are coming on board. They understand. They understand that the third rail should be allowing a 24% benefit cut for those who are currently receiving and those who receive in the future. And they understood that, and they made a commitment to work together.
Speaking to retirees at an AARP event in D.C., Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy.
So I will say, among the folks I worked with, absolutely they understand that. I'll also say that we're making progress on the House side. Both parties interested in coming up with a solution. So I think there's that awareness. Right now is the absence of presidential leadership. Mm. It takes both parties, both houses, and a president who is willing to go there. And right now, our leading candidates are not willing to go there.
Talking about the issue with Social Security and the debt and borrowing more money.
When you say borrowing, what you really mean is our nation's indebtedness. So the unfunded accrued liabilities of Social Security, those promises made to us as Americans, that accounts over the next 70 years for about one-fifth of our nation's indebtedness. That single program is one-fifth of our nation's indebtedness. With our plan, we take care of that one-fifth. Mm-hmm. At the end of the 70 years, we have the money. In fact, if this goes like the actuaries predict it might go, we will evergreen the fund, which is to say that never again will we worry about a Social Security shortfall. It always will have enough revenue coming in from the investments to pay scheduled benefits. That's pretty remarkable.
It would be.
That is a pretty good anti-deficit program. And that also, did I tell you? No, I didn't. She didn't ask. We also have a poverty alleviation program in here, in which the actuaries say that this is the most powerful poverty alleviation program for the elderly since Social Security was originally passed. We repeal the retirement earnings test, which if you go back to work after you're on social, you get $1,000 a month cut in your social payment. Why are you going back to work? Which, by the way, would help workforce availability because the boomers, I'm a boomer, we got a lot of work left in us at age 65, but you kept me $1,000 on my social, maybe I'll just sit home and fish. And one more thing, we also repeal weapon GPO, windfall elimination provision and government pension offset, which affects my state, affects California and Texas and Illinois. So I say all that because we've got things in here that make the program stronger as well as address our nation's indebtedness. Yes, there is short-term borrowing, but that short-term borrowing is accounted for.
If it's such a big deal, will the problem be solved soon?
It will not happen before the next presidential election because President Biden has made it clear that he's not going to act on it. We briefed the White House on four separate occasions. They have said this publicly. I'm not telling you anything which is not known for multi-hours. And by the way, we're not going to put out paper because there are dials. We need a president who will say, okay, we're going to turn this dial or that dial. I can tell you how we originally construed it, but that's what a president's about. The president's going to say, we want to turn this up and we want to turn that down. So we need a president to come up with the final language. But President Biden made it clear that he's not going to address this. He didn't, in his State of the Union speech, he did not speak about the bipartisan plan that had seven senators from each party that he had been briefed on. Rather, he spoke about a single senator's plan that he had retreated from. As we walk out, a Democratic colleague said, well, he's running for re-election, attacking Republicans on social, and our plan is dead for this Congress. So my hope is we can do it next Congress.
This is Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I joined A&M about 5 years ago, or about 3.5 years ago, as his partner. So he and I are co-directors of the Ag and Food Policy Center.
Dr. Bart Fisher referring to the co-director of the Agriculture and Food Policy Center, Dr. Joe Outlaw.
Prior to that, I spent 8.5 years in Washington, D.C. I was the chief economist of the House Ag Committee, first working for Chairman Lucas from Western Oklahoma on the 2014 Farm Bill, then staying on to work with Chairman Conaway on the 2018 Farm Bill. I worked on things like getting seed cotton added back to the Farm Bill back in 2018. And so after about 8.5 years, I got married and had 3 kids along the way, decided it was time to get them back to God's country. So we moved back to Texas. Prior to that, I had done my PhD at A&M, but I grew up in southwestern Oklahoma, pretty much straight east of here on a dry land cotton farm. We grow cotton, wheat, cattle as well. Still pretty involved. Dad says I'm not that involved. I like to think I'm pretty engaged back home still. On the farm, try to stay pretty plugged in, but spend my days working at AFBC. I will say I teach about 186 undergraduate students on Tuesdays and Thursdays covering ag policy.
Following a loss at the World Trade Organization for a challenge brought by Brazil, U.S. lawmakers pulled cotton out of the farm program, but put a program called Stacks in its place.
It is something we are working on internally, but are having conversations with the Hill on. So I'm not going to put words in their mouth on what they may or may not be considering, but it's certainly something that we're working on and we're having conversations with them about. To me, I mean, the point I'm going to be making is I think that's eminently reasonable.
He's referring to the fact that a producer who chooses Stacks cannot participate in PLC.
You know, at the time, if you think through the progression, if you look at 14, it was Lent was completely out as a cover commodity. Stacks was all that was left. When we get to the Bipartisan Budget Act of 18, well, cotton is back in. We had tried cotton seed. That didn't work, and so I'm sitting in the office thinking, well, let's just put them both together. Seed cotton's now going to be the covered commodity. And we came up with the price series to do it and set the reference price. And so you have all of that at play, but at that point in time, the other side folks who were advocating on the other side of the table said, well, you know, now that cotton is a covered commodity, you know, Stacks was offered in lieu of being a covered commodity. Now that it is a covered commodity, Stacks has to go away. That's what we were told. And so we fought that for several weeks, and one of the main arguments we made was the base acre argument, right, that not everybody has it. And then the compromise was, okay, we'll bring it back, but you cannot have both, right? And it's the only one. With SCO, I mean, and you can go buy SCO now and have PLC. And so part of our thinking is that if we do come up with a streamlined policy, there's a lot of money in Stacks for budget. And so some cotton growers may say, well, I don't want to give up. I mean, we already have a decent product. Let's not, you know, mess with it. It's all downside. Well, where could there be some upside? There could be some upside in a compromise that says, okay, well, just like SCO, you can have anyone who gets this new area-wide coverage can also have PLC, where there's no choice to be made. And so it's not that Congress is advocating or that they're considering it now, but it's absolutely something, you know, we're going to be visiting with them about. And I know at least on the House side, you know, their commodity staff, are also from West Texas, who understand these issues incredibly well. And it's something that he, so if y'all know Trevor White from down at New Home, it's something he's talked about a lot as well. It's just the need to tighten up on the top end all these area coverages. And it's only gotten more complicated with the advent of ECO. And so to me, I think there's a very real possibility there. I think it can make for a very robust safety net if done right.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
On behalf of my farmers and ranchers, I just want to say thanks for you being a strong voice at the White House, interacting with the administration, especially where the EPA meets agriculture.
Earlier this year, Dr. Roger Marshall, senator from Kansas, member of the Senate Ag Committee, to Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
The EPA reached out to USDA for comments on atrazine mitigation practices on March 1st, 2022. Your Office of Pest Management recommended EPA add additional mitigation practices and augment some others. In the proposed rule ultimately published by the EPA, none of the edits or suggested mitigations from USDA were involved or included. EPA similarly hasn't considered your comments on rodenticides as well as chlorpyrifos. Considering EPA is refusing to meaningfully consider USDA OPMP's comments, would you support legislative action requiring them to respond to your career experts on pesticide issues publicly in the Federal Register?
Well, I think it's important to have a respectful relationship between two agencies, Senator. I think it's important for us to continue to have the opportunity to provide input in terms of the impact of whatever EPA is considering. I would hope that under circumstances they would consider the career folks at USDA because they come with good information and good data. I think it's be interesting to see how you would craft that in terms of one department basically overruling another department. I'm not sure I want the EPA telling me how to run the Department of Agriculture, so I just be careful in terms of how you.
Do you feel like the EPA is listening to your experts?
I think they are in some circumstances. There's an honest dispute and disagreement from time to time, and the response that I have to that, Senator, is when there is a disagreement and EPA enacts whatever they're going to enact, then it's our job at USDA to do what we can to mitigate the consequence of that, to use the resources, the programs that we have, if possible, to mitigate the consequences.
So in order to utilize environmentally sound practices like no-till farming, which we've been doing for over 20 years on our family farm, we have to have use of these pesticides. Otherwise, we're going to have to go back to plowing, which creates an increased carbon footprint. Do you feel like the EPA is balancing this issue of carbon footprint? So they're using their practices. We're going to have to plow the ground, which we know is a huge carbon sink.
We have raised that issue with them repeatedly.
And what do they say?
They have a disagreement with us, Senator.
Okay.
I don't know.
Thank you.
Dealing with EPA is not the only area that Marshall was concerned about. There was also trade or lack thereof.
The challenge, I think, is to build trust in this country in trade. Agriculture farmers understand the importance of trade because of historic surpluses. They understand it. They appreciate it. But that's not true of all industries and not all parts of the country. There are folks who believe that trade is not.
So do you have any concrete steps that you can let us know what's happening on the trade side of agriculture?
Sure. There's framework, the Indo-Pacific framework. There are negotiations with the EU on a variety of SBS issues. There's the issue involving Canada and trying to make sure that they live up to the USMCA with dairy. There's the issue in Mexico in terms of the ability to assure that biotech corn can be used. There are tariff reductions in Vietnam that resulted in more pork sales. There are additional issues in Central American countries where we have created additional opportunities. There's a whole variety of things going on in the trade front that don't necessarily require free trade agreements, but they do require breaking down barriers. They do require restoring trust. They do require saying when we have a trade agreement, we're going to enforce it. And that's precisely what we're doing with the USMCA.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Yeah, I think so. We always have a farm bill. Sometimes it takes longer than others, and I think this year will be one of those weird years.
Dr. Joe Outlaw is co-director of the Agriculture Food Policy Center at Texas A&M.
The current bill expires September 30th of this year, and you're going to hear all kinds of talk about having, if we don't get an extension, we're going to fall back onto the 49 Act and some of the previous legislation that's completely different than what we have now. Really, until we get to Christmas, I'm not worried about getting the farm bill done. They will do a short-term extension if they need to, but I really see them getting it done before too long into the new year. And if that doesn't happen, I'll just say, if that doesn't happen, then it's going to probably be a multi-year extension, and we'll have to revisit this after the presidential election.
There have been a lot of listening sessions up to this point. What are lawmakers hearing?
Right now, I mean, most of the commodity groups that testified in Washington asked for a higher reference price, which is the minimum, the guarantee price that crops get protected at. And that is what they're struggling to find the resources to do. Obviously, everyone knows that costs have gone up significantly, and they're trying to increase the reference price so that they can cover a lot more of the costs. And so that's going to cost, depending upon what level you move it to. And if you move it to the same level for all commodities, which I'm going to say in a few minutes, the word I'm getting is they're not going to do it across the board like they've tended to do in the past. It just costs too much money to move some of the crops because of all the acres. So it will be interesting to see what they actually find the funds for. But really, reference prices is number one thing. Some adjustments to crop insurance, and I've heard what some of them are, and they're actually going to be good for the state in this area of the state. And then there is probably a 50-50 chance that they do something about a base update there's a lot of producers out there, out the countryside, that don't have crop base, and that's what, you know, if you don't have crop base, you don't get protection on Title I. And so they're trying to find a way to increase the base for those farmers who have land that doesn't have base on it. With the expectation is that costs money, and everything you do to make people better off costs money. Even if the prices are high like they are now and they don't spend the money, scorekeeping agency in Washington will make it, will assume it's going to cost, and they have to find that money.
If they're looking for money, they don't have to look at it for conservation.
Conservation really got bolstered last June when they did the Inflation Reduction Act. Basically, conservation got boosted, almost doubling the money for conservation in the act that was passed last summer that also included a lot of money for carbon. And so Farm Bill is not going to do anything on conservation this time to speak of because it was all done last summer.
It looks like a slim possibility of getting a 23 farm bill. So what's ahead for 24?
The number one point is can they find resources to fund the things that they know, the changes they need to make? Right now, there's been discussion on House and Senate. Hey, we need more resources, billions of dollars more to do this bill so we can make the bill, provide the protection so we don't have to do all this ad hoc assistance after the fact. And frankly, they've been trying for about a year to find this money, and they've got some savings they think they can find from unspent COVID money and stuff like that. But to date, no one has come forward with this is additional funds you can do the farm bill with. And that's kind of really what we're waiting on this whole time. It's been waiting on finding a significant influx of money.
Dr. Joe Outlaw with the Agriculture Food Policy Center at Texas A&M. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You would think that the right hand of the government sort of knows what the left is doing.
Sigrid Johannes is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and the Public Lands Council on the Lesser Prairie Chicken.
And NRCS regularly reviews grazing plans, you know, all the time for, you know, through initiatives like Working Lands for Wildlife, for example. You also have entities out, you know, further in Colorado and New Mexico, like the BLM or the Forest Service, who are also regularly reviewing those grazing plans. What is especially troubling about this situation is we've, you know, asked point blank, is NRCS going to be on that approved list of reviewers? And as of now, the answer from Fish and Wildlife is no. They are not going to be on that list. And there's been a lot of inconsistent reports across northern Texas and parts of the panhandle on, you know, on a county-by-county basis. Offices are getting different guidance, and some of them are, you know, looking at plans and signing off. Others are not. It's just a very uncertain situation, and you can see the mess that this creates on the ground when you have federal, you know, bureaucrats in D.C. who are making a rule for people, you know, many, many hundreds of miles away and completely removed from the landscape and what it actually takes to conserve this habitat and support the bird.
It probably is important to note that the area of concern has been battling drought for 3 years.
It's not a coincidence. It's a correlation between that dip in numbers that you see when we get these extreme drought conditions. And unfortunately, you know, this is a species that's very susceptible to those changes in precipitation. It's very sensitive to those changes in the climate and in the environment that, you know, result in some of these very dry and arid conditions. Another big factor is, you know, habitat loss, not through cattle ranching, not through grazing, but through fire. You know, wildfire season used to be something that people only really thought of in the West, and it moves further east every year. There are significant, you know, prairie fires, rangeland fires in that middle belt of the country. So that's also taking a chunk out of the habitat each year. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, the lesser prairie chicken, it might only affect 5 states today, but this is a model from Fish and Wildlife that could easily be applied to other birds that have, you know, historically had ups and downs in population that get blamed on cattle producers. Think of the sage grouse, you know, think of the greater prairie chicken, think of the monarch butterfly, think of all of the other creatures that, you know, hop, crawl, fly, you know, and you could easily apply this system to a lot of other states across the country. And I think that's a perfect example of why some of these regional issues have to be, you know, on the national docket for NCBA to work on.
But when it comes to the lesser prairie chicken, landowners, livestock producers all gathered together and came up with a plan.
When I say that cattle producers are the sole reason that this bird is still thriving out there, I mean, that is no exaggeration. 96% of lesser prairie chicken range falls on private lands. You literally cannot conserve the habitat without the buy-in of these private landowners and private ranchers. And, you know, for many years, as you mentioned, Tony, people have entered into these agreements called candidate conservation agreements with assurances. And these are essentially contracts, that stipulate how they're going to manage the habitat, what steps they're going to take to support, you know, higher numbers of birds, successful nesting seasons, etc. And we found those to be very successful. The areas where you have a lot of folks bought into these CCAAs, you see a lot of improvement for the species and for the landscape, frankly, that then just yields dividends. It benefits other wildlife species, it benefits livestock, you know, and the list goes on. So what's really disappointing is you see this voluntary success, you see this great public-private partnership in some of these areas, and rather than capitalizing on and supporting that success, Fish and Wildlife basically has airdropped in and said, we can do it better, we know better. And that's just not a theme that we've found to work really for any species, and we don't think it'll work for this one.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A multilateral trading system is a global public good.
Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is the Director General of the World Trade Organization, WTO.
I've termed it that. It's a global public good, and we need multilateralism to solve some problems. So even as we have these geopolitical tensions, even as we have strategic competition, we must remember that we also need strategic cooperation to solve climate change and all the other issues of the global commons.
She explains why trade tensions continue to rise.
The reason the rhetoric against and the tension is high, on at least on the trade side, is the feeling that some members, and say China, may be pursuing practices in subsidizing their enterprises that may go against the level playing field that the WTO supports. And if you talk to China, China will tell you that they're also concerned that some other types of subsidies, including agricultural subsidies, may be also going against the level playing field, and some of the countries in the West are doing that. So what is WTO members, especially the large countries and the developing countries too, all have complaints about level playing field issues. This is fueling some of the suspicion and the aggravation and the talk against trade. So let me end by saying, look, let us not let our sentiments run away with the actual facts. We are working now to look at, lay out the facts on subsidies across the board. From the WTO, we've joined with the World Bank and the IMF and the OECD, all these international organizations, to look at this issue and try to get the facts on the table so that we can begin a conversation that can actually lead us to do away with these suspicions and try and restore the balance in terms of how the trade is being seen and perceived.
The U.S. has long been pushing for reforms, especially in the areas of disputes and appeals.
It's going to be quite a tough conversation, Doug. That's what I'm sensing. What I sense from the other members is that they still want a two-tier system. Now, let me step back and say that some of the criticisms made by the U.S. I think are valid, and we need to recognize that. There's no reason why they say the appellate body should take more than the 90 days to give rulings that was originally mandated, and it goes into years. That may be because cases are getting more complicated and sophisticated, but we can do something about this. Overreach, yes, maybe we need to look at some of that. So there are some valid criticisms. Other members have it too. Developing countries feel the system is not easy to access. But there is a strong desire amongst most of the membership for a two-tier system. Now, does that two-tier system mean it's necessarily the appellate body recreated the way it was before? I'm not sure. Can there be ways to have a two-tier system that is somewhat different and more creative? Maybe. I sense more openness now to discussing that on all sides than I did before. I think a few months ago, you know, members would say the appellate body. And some are still saying that. But I sense now more openness to discussing other ways. Whether it will be what you said, an ad hoc, I don't know. It's going to be a very tough conversation, but we need to go there.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The very tight majority in the House, even though the Republicans hold the House, that tight majority relative to the previous farm bills makes it even tougher to do this bill.
Dr. Joe Outlaw is co-director of Texas A&M's Ag and Food Policy Center.
So it makes it where it's a lot more uncertain about when they're going to get it done. I don't have any question they're going to get it done. It's just a matter of when. And, you know, Washington doesn't function without a crisis anymore, and that's what we need. And we don't have a crisis. We have relatively good crop prices, really good livestock prices, at least for beef. And so where's the crisis at? And so, frankly, they're going to have run out of time, so that's the crisis. Because the ag world has not come and portrayed that they're in any kind of serious problems.